professional sports franchises contribute to the economic base of a city and have the potential to build community pride. Today, we look at the tale of two cities and the choices they've made, one with a pointed success and one that may soon not have a team at all. I am Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. Oakland, California, directly across the bay from San Francisco, has a long history of major league sports franchises, winning championships, growing fans, and grooming athletes as well. But Oakland, after losing the Golden State Warriors basketball team and the Oakland Raiders football team, are now on the brink of saying goodbye to their baseball team, the Oakland A's. In just a minute, we'll visit with Andy Dolish, author, along with Dave Newhouse, of Goodbye Oakland, Winning, Wanderlust, and a Sports Town's Fight for Survival. A little later, we'll talk with journalist Dale Tafoya, who brings an exciting story of a different city, Huntsville, Alabama, whose embrace of a AA ball club changed the town and, to an extent, the players on the team. One season in Rocket City, how the 1985 Huntsville Stars brought minor league baseball fever to Alabama. Stay with us. It's a novel idea. Oakland has always been a place of character, but sometimes overshadowed by the city across the bay. It's always been a strong sports town, too, yielding many championship teams in basketball, football, and baseball. But over the past decade or two, the power dynamics have shifted and owners picked up their teams and moved elsewhere, no matter the impact to the community or the fans. Andy Dolish is a sports executive who has been involved in professional sports for just about 50 years and has worked with teams in the NFL, NBA, the National Hockey League, and in Major League Baseball. He was instrumental in helping build back the Oakland Athletics organization under the legendary ownership of the Haas family. Co-author Dave Newhouse has been writing about the Bay Area sports scene for many, many years, was a sports writer for the Oakland Tribune, and is the author of 19 books. Let's now listen to my conversation with Andy Dolish on Goodbye Oakland, Winning, Wanderlust, and a Sports Town's Fight for Survival. Andy, the book covers a lot of territory in the history of sports in Oakland, some of the early teams that called Oakland home. You talk about many of the teams, the victories and championships, and you talk about the homegrown athletes that went on to have successful careers and a lot of the people who supported that. But ultimately, this is a tale of loss and disappointment, but not without its sense of pride and hope as well. So why right now, especially with the Oakland A's packing their bags, why you chose to put this book out into the world right now?
Sure. First of all, thank you for having me as a guest. And a simple answer is that Oakland and its great history in sport became part of my DNA when I moved here from the East Coast in December of 1980 to work for the Haas family, who had just bought the team from Charlie Finley. We'll talk a bit more about that later, I'm sure. But I kept thinking about the fact that the Bay Area is a complex environment. And when you come from other places in the country, you don't quite get Oakland, San Francisco, Marin County, Monterey, Sacramento. The Bay Area and Northern California is not just one place. It's a combination of all, which also has an incredible, incredible history in sports. And so I went to my good friend, Dave Newhouse, the 30-year leading sports columnist of the then Oakland Tribune. And Dave has written a number of sports books. I was just getting started as a writer and said, what do you think about this idea? Telling the story of multiple decades especially with what's happening now, as you mentioned, Suzanne, with the A's. And he said, I'm in. And that was the first part of it. The more complicated part, when we talked to publishers around the country, they said, oh, that's just Oakland. Thank you. Drive home safely. And when the story of Las Vegas really started showing up in New York, Chicago, other big cities around the country, that's when the publisher called back and said, okay, write the rest of the book.
I think that a lot of people are still reeling with the thought of losing yet another team, especially the Oakland A's. There any chance for last minute rescues or sweeping in of some heroic figure or a lawsuit or something like that?
That is the combination that I'm looking at. I'm a Brooklyn born cynic raised in the East, but I am unbelievably optimistic about the opportunity of this deal unraveling in Las Vegas. And ironically, there was a newspaper headline in the last day or two about the A's minor league ballpark in Summerlin, which is just outside Las Vegas. And it said something like a sellout crowd at A's minor league park with a temperature of 114 degrees. So, seriously speaking, the A's have said they have to play or would play in their minor league ballpark for several years, three or four, before their dome stadium is built. And the minor league ballpark in Las Vegas is not domed. So to your answer as what could happen, number one, Major League Baseball players who are making ungodly amounts of money are not going to play in unsafe conditions. That's number one. Number two, even though the A's received $385 million of public money, taxpayer-supported money, for their project, the actual dome stadium will cost around $1.5 billion.
Wow.
That's more than $385 million, right, Suzanne, I think?
Yes.
And who's going to pay for that? John Fisher has publicly stated, well, that's an oxymoron. He stated through other people, because he doesn't make any public statements and hasn't in 19 years, at least not that we've seen, that everything would be 100% privately financed in terms of building a new ballpark. Well, how does $385 million equal 100% privately financed? And the Nevada State Teachers Association has begun a lawsuit against the state legislature about this very amount of money, the specific $385 million. You approved that, state legislator. What about education? What about salaries? What about safety? So that's starting to work through the system. And you also have a circumstance that the A's are moving into what is now a crowded sports market with the Las Vegas Golden Knights, the current Stanley Cup champions, the Las Vegas Raiders, a number of collegiate basketball tournaments played at the end of the season, and a rumor which will be a reality, the NBA is going to expand, I believe, to Las Vegas in the next few years. And then the third part of your question is legal and legislative blockage by those in Oakland. I believe, without being a lawyer, that there is an eminent domain lawsuit against the A's for the 50% of the land that they own at the Coliseum, constructive eviction case based upon the way the A's have treated the facility, and a number of other legal capabilities that Oakland, elected officials have, and we'll see what they intend to do, this being clearly extra innings using baseball parlance.
Andy, I think that just how you framed this conversation also is indicative of how you present information in the book without pulling any punches, really. And there are some, I'll just say, villains in the book.
Yes.
Oddly, or not oddly, their owners, a team owners. So you just mentioned how the Raiders, once the Oakland Raiders, then they moved south to LA or were moved down there. Then they moved back up to Oakland in
right.
Kind of a reconditioned stadium, and then down to LA under the regimes of Al Davis and now his son, Mark Davis. And so they kind of typify this greedy, ego-driven owners. And in the book, you really do detail about Al Davis's whole history, you know, coming into the Raiders. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about Al and Mark Davis and their impact on football and their impact on Oakland.
When you look at that history of how Al Davis went from, you know, a football coach, also East Coast, New York Metro born, coaching in college and then moving into the pros, I would say, having worked for a number of professional organizations in sports during my ongoing career in the big four sports, so three NBA teams, the Oakland A's, Washington Capitals hockey, and San Francisco 49ers, there is a real simple view that I developed early, and that is the color of the fluid that flows through the veins of sports is a real simple color called green. And wherever ownership can find the most green, whether there are silver and black of the Raiders, that's where they're going to go. And Davis was always looking for the better deal. And as you mentioned in the question, hey, you're going to Los Angeles, you're going to Irwindale, you're coming back here, you're building this ridiculous Mount Davis, which helped to destroy one of the most beautiful panoramas in sports at Oakland A's games, looking at the beautiful Oakland Hills. Al Davis was always looking for the next quick buck. And his circumstances didn't work out that well in LA, where you'd think, how could you blow that one in a larger market? Now, Mark Davis is not going to be nominated for any upcoming Nobel Prizes. Can I say that, Suzanne, on the air? I guess I just did, right? In these situations, it's not just the team. It's not just an Al Davis, Mark Davis, John Fisher, Joe Lacob, Peter Guber of moving over time. It's the league, it's elected officials, and it's the ownership of the team. But specifically to Al Davis, it didn't work for him. And Mark is looking at, I got to build a new football stadium in Oakland because the Raiders and the A's are the last two teams, were the last two teams in professional sport to share the same stadium. Well, that was a non-starter in terms of Oakland. And then this deal to have the Raiders go to Las Vegas, in my view, was much more a league-directed business operation by Roger Goodell, Robert Kraft, the owner of the Patriots, Jerry Jones, the owner of the Cowboys, who said, you know what? Gaming is going to become, legalized betting is going to become a major factor in our sport. What better beta test of a team could we have than sending the Raiders to Las Vegas? Because Mark Davis will just go, sounds good to me, when do I leave? And that's what happened. It wasn't a brilliantly negotiated deal by Mark. It was a negotiated deal by the power of the NFL.
You know, there is also something cynical about that move, in that there's a pretty strong fan base here. And it seems like they were almost relying on that fan base in Oakland of kind of following the team to Vegas. And indeed, I think there are many fans, and at least one you talk about in the book, that, yeah, he has season tickets down there.
Right.
But there does seem to be something in your whole conversation about the money that really doesn't include the fans.
Well, it includes the fans if you're scanning their credit card or cashing their check. And that is another area that I look at very, very closely, there are three foundational elements that are necessary for any successful sports franchise, and for that matter, any successful business: teamwork, leadership, and trust. And if your fan base doesn't trust you, you have difficulty. Teamwork, well, that plays out on the field, but you also have to work with your fans if you're ownership. And leadership defines itself in how successful or not you're going to be. So in many instances, sports owners or owners of some businesses go, well, the heck with you. I'm the owner. It's a privately held business, but I've always been taught by the places that I've been and the owners that I've respected that it's really a public entity. Even though I, the owner, actually legally can make decisions, but the heart, mind, and soul of a fan base is pretty hard to quantify. And when you rip a team out of a marketplace, you know, people forget the Brooklyn Dodgers went to LA. Who's playing baseball in Brooklyn now? The Seattle Supersonics, who now play in Oklahoma City, they were massively part of the DNA and the heart, mind, and soul of Seattle. And that didn't stop owners and leagues from going where they thought the pastures were greener with greenbacks.
Well, getting back to ownership and some of our teams in Oakland, you mentioned a minute ago, Peter Guber and Joe Lacob, and they have also done some moving around of the Warriors who had a very successful stint in Oakland.
I like the way that you understated a bit of success in Oakland. How about 364, that's 364 consecutive sellouts at the Oakland Arena, the Coliseum, before they moved to Chase Center? I would say that's fairly successful. Would you agree, Suzanne?
Yes, yes.
So their case was a little bit different than Davis is. I'm a Bedouin. I'm always looking for the best oasis. Joe Lacob and Peter Guber said, what's missing in San Francisco? A major sports and entertainment complex indoors. Right? The Giants built a beautiful ballpark 23 years ago. Hard to believe it's 23. But the most up-to-date arena essentially was the Cow Palace, which is an oxymoron in terms of up-to-date. So they wanted to build this world-class arena, which they did, for a nice little cost of about $1.8 billion for an arena. And they never even negotiated with the then mayor of Oakland. And they said, no need, we're leaving. There's nothing you can do for us. But they absolutely, talk about wanderlust, Suzanne, they wanted to go to that zip code in San Francisco. It's been very successful, but they also said, oh, it's just the bridge, all of those fans from Oakland, the East Bay, the peninsula, they'll just zip into the city and park for, you know, $80 or whatever it might be. So that was another case of, yeah, we'll go. They'll come with us. And to a certain extent, because the geography makes it easier, but they just wanted a ATM machine of incredible Taj Mahal proportions, which they built in Chase Center.
You touch on a couple of things that I want to follow up with in a minute, but I want to get back to the whole ownership concept with the A's. You mentioned John Fisher, the current owner, and the A's were brought to Oakland by another owner, Charles O. Finley, who is perhaps infamous in the history of the Oakland A's. And he also didn't invest a lot in the team and also had very low attendance, though a string of winning...
three consecutive World Series. Who's done that lately?
Yes. But then the Haas family came in, and you had the distinction of working with them, and they had a real civic sense about team ownership that maybe is very, very rare now in professional sports. So talk about that distinction of the Haas family versus the other owners of the Oakland A's.
Yes, just a moment on Charlie Finley, a great self-promoter. I never understood why a man who did a lot to advance baseball and clearly put one of the greatest teams in the last 40 or 50 years, winning 72, 73, 74, three consecutive World Series. But what Finley realized in the late 70s is, yeah, I'm rich, but I'm not as rich as CBS. I'm not as rich as Ted Turner. I'm not as rich as some other owners in baseball. I won't be able to compete. And he made a decision, you know, which I don't think was positive, but he pulled his team apart. He sold off his best players. And as you said, they were a complete mess. And then when the Haases bought the team in the summer of 1980 for $11.2 million, which sounds laughable today, Walter Haas, his son Wally, Roy Eisenhardt, his son-in-law, who was the president, Wally was the EVP. What I was able to experience, along with millions and millions of other people, is the Haas viewed the team as a public entity. What can we, the Haas family, do to increase the enjoyment of all of these fans throughout Northern California, which was never done before, vis-a-vis the A's? And the fans responded. We also had one heck of a good baseball team, because in sports, job number one is winning, or winning championships. So the Haas family, they did everything in their power to work with the city and county, with fan bases, with community institutions, with major businesses. And they basically laid down that as our strategy as we were doing business throughout the time that they owned the team. To me, having worked for nine different ownerships in sports, far and away, the best group, because they managed with their heart and their soul and not just their checkbook.
And it sounds, just from your mentioning it in the book, that this was maybe a very vibrant time for you in your career, and that you were behind a lot of manifesting these very creative promotions and getting fans into the stadium to enjoy the game. So talk a little bit just for a minute about how that was for you.
Again, it goes back to those three simple foundational elements, Suzanne: teamwork, leadership, and trust. When the Haases bought the team from Finley, there was no front office, meaning there was no sales staff, no promotion staff, not much of a ticket office, no community relations, no public relations. And so they basically beefed that up, gave me the ability to hire what I thought were the best and brightest people around. And many of those people became leaders in the sports industry. We were just young pups at that time. But they gave us, the Haas family, gave us the opportunity to go out and not just be successful, but, you know, try something. And even if it doesn't work, that's okay. We've learned something from it. And we tried to also have fun at the ballpark. So Crazy George and the Wave and mascots and incredible fireworks shows. I'll put us against any team in sport as having some of the best fireworks shows ever. We didn't take ourselves too seriously. And I got an insight, again, in the early 80s, that sports isn't just sports, it's entertainment.
You know, you also in the book talk about a lot of the homegrown athletes in Oakland who have been mentored by people, and you talk about that in the book, about some of those people, but how they have gone on to contribute significantly to the sports that they've been involved with. And one of those being Dave Stewart.
Right.
It seems like he has also been involved in trying to keep the A's in Oakland. So talk just a little bit about Dave Stewart.
Well, before I get into Dave, you have some of the greatest names in baseball, Frank Robinson, Ricky Henderson, Vada Pinson, Curt Flood, who sort of changed the economic structure of professional athletics, and Dave Smoke Stewart from Oakland. And Dave wanted to basically buy the city's half of the Coliseum. And the city made a decision, no, we're going to deal with another group, the African-American Sports and Entertainment Group that they're talking to. And Dave went, are you kidding me? Do you know what I've done, where I've been, what I've learned? And he is now leading a expansion baseball effort in Nashville. He should be leading the effort in Oakland, but Oakland said goodbye. And Dave represents, you know, an incredible power of personality and greatness as a baseball player. How does Major League Baseball, Suzanne, make a decision to leave one of the most diverse marketplaces in the country, African American, Asian, South Asian, Latino, people from all over the world here, and go to Vegas, which isn't a diverse marketplace to that level? How does it leave the sixth most impactful economic location in the country to the 40th? It makes no sense. And that's what is so frustrating and maddening to so many of us and millions of A's fans that hopefully believe there will be some sort of cosmic interference with this move to Las Vegas.
Why do you think that the politicians aren't seeing the value that professional sports is bringing to their community and working harder?
I believe, and it's, you know, I won't put this on anybody else, that tactics, Suzanne, are not strategy. And a lot of what you've seen from Oakland elected officials has just been tactical, not strategic. Oakland is doing many things right because of the real estate prices in the Bay Area and its coolness and its hipness and its vibe. But it seems that the local officials are just not getting the message on how to work strategically with all parts of their community to create, in my view, a SEAL Team 6 to make sure that the third team doesn't head to the desert.
Yes, a former mayoral candidate who did not win, but he was a longtime Oakland City Councilman, Ignacio de la Fuente. He says that none of the politicians in Oakland had the backbone to do the work in retaining our teams, and that Oakland is its own worst enemy.
Ignacio Nacho de la Fuente. There is a gentleman that knows how to fight. We worked with Ignacio when he was on the city council and many other leaders in the community long time ago, George Vukasin and Cornell Meyer, the head of Kaiser Aluminum and Chemical at that time. There are a number of men and women who were leaders in the community. And if they had something to say, they said it not behind closed doors, but in front of microphones or anybody else. And Ignacio to this day is direct and to the point, and I couldn't agree with him more.
Whether the A's leave or not, what's your ultimate take and what do you want to leave us with?
I'd always want to leave with optimism and the marketplace, not just Oakland, but as we've talked about through this discussion in the Bay Area, is significant. It has the resources, it has the demographics, it has the coolness, it has the media support. However, when you have a team that is owned by an owner who doesn't care about that, that sends a message to other owners. I happen to believe if John Fisher would have sold the team 3 years ago to someone else who cared about the market, a new ballpark would already be up and running at the Coliseum. I do believe that the leagues, especially the NFL, would not come back to Oakland, especially with the Niners here. I believe the NBA will not be back to Oakland. I believe they'll be in Las Vegas before they'll consider anything. The African American Sports and Entertainment Group is heavily promoting the WNBA. That'll be fine to play in the arena, but it's not the same as basketball, baseball, and football. And because of the lack of a major power in elected officials who are all on the same page and not pointing at each other, that is a difficult level to overcome if a league is looking at expansion.
Goodbye, Oakland. Winning, wanderlust, and a sports town's fight for survival by our guest Andy Dolish and Dave Newhouse. Andy, thanks so much for talking to me today about this book and this situation, and I really appreciate it.
It was a pleasure. Hopefully, as we talked about, there are miracles that happen in sports all the time. Hopefully the A's staying in Oakland is one of them. Appreciate it, Suzanne.
My conversation with Andy Dolish, who along with Dave Newhouse gives us Goodbye Oakland, Winning, Wanderlust, and a Sports Town's Fight for Survival. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. Let's take a short break before we talk with Dale Tafoya on a completely different sports scene that he gives us in his book, One Season in Rocket City, How the 1985 Huntsville Stars Brought Minor League Baseball Fever to Alabama. Stay with us. Suzanne Lang with A Novel Idea. Dale Tafoya is a journalist and a sports fan. He has written many articles, and his previous books include Bash Brothers, A Legacy Subpoenaed on Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco and the Age of Steroids, and Billy Ball, Billy Martin and the Resurrection of the Oakland A's. Now he brings us One Season in Rocket City, How the 1985 Huntsville Stars Brought Minor League Baseball Fever to Alabama. Huntsville is known for the aerospace industry, but it's also a place of civic pride and political leadership that pumped up the city and gave a good ride to the baseball players who played there. Tafoya is detailed with his facts, but has fun with the material and creates a momentum to the story, which is as exciting as the game. Let's listen to my conversation with Dale Tafoya. In this book, you set up the scenario of minor league ball in general and the moving parts, the players and affiliates. And the way you structured the book had a real building momentum to it. So before we get in deeply into the story, I wonder if you could talk about your approach to such a niche of a story with so much detail, and really what drew you to Huntsville.
Well, Suzanne, when I was writing my first book, Bash Brothers, back in the early 2000s, I delved into the year Jose Canseco. He was one of the Bass brothers. I delved into the year Jose Canseco passed through Huntsville in 1985. That was the A's AA affiliate at the time. And after interviewing dozens of people connected with that season there, the late Don Mincher, who's Mr. Baseball in Huntsville, he was the Huntsville Stars general manager that year. Mark McCarter, he's a great writer in Huntsville. The late Bob Mays, he was the Stars beat writer for the Huntsville Times that year. What really jumped out was just the life and the joy and the electricity and breath of fresh air that this farm club brought to the community. The city had a new star-studded, state-of-the-art baseball stadium with a star-studded roster of players. And the stadium was named after the mayor, Joe W. Davis. And fans just poured into the stadium to watch the team. And there was a baseball awakening. I love writing about baseball awakenings in cities and how a community can rally around a team and what a team can do to a community. And so there was just a special romance between the club and the community. And the Stars were the product of the perfect timing for the city and the rise of Oakland's top prospect. So I was excited to write the book. There just wasn't a lot of material and photos available from that season to write a book. And that's what made it challenging. The Huntsville newspapers that intimately covered that season were not on any public online archives, where a lot of newspapers archive them. So I needed to travel to Huntsville and basically live in the downtown library there for about a week. And for photos, I found the Alabama Department of Archives and History and finally unearthed some for the book. So there were some challenges, but with the fresh material and the hard work I did to kind of unearth this story, I think I'm excited the book came out with a lot of the fresh material from 1985 in Huntsville.
Well, you tell a real exciting story, and I liked the pacing of the book, that you set up the building blocks of the team coming to Huntsville, of the politicians in Huntsville who wanted a team. And for our listeners, Huntsville is known for the aerospace industry being there, but people seem to feel that it needed something more, and they sure got it.
Yeah, well, the idea, and it was the determination from Mayor Joe W. Davis. He was the Huntsville's five-term mayor, and he loved baseball, and he wanted to bring a farm club there, a team there, to unite the community, to bring the community together, to excite the community. And at the time, Huntsville desperately needed an outlet to bring the community together. It was recognized, as you mentioned, as a celebrated space town after Wernher von Braun arrived and designed the Saturn V rocket that shot man to the moon during the space race with the Soviet Union. And before that, it was a cotton and cattle town. Huntsville had also quietly become a high-tech mecca, and a lot of sophisticated and educated scientists and engineers settled in Huntsville for work. And the population soared. Around 1985, it soared to 160,000. Huntsville became a hotbed for research and development. But for entertainment, they had the Redstone Arsenal. They had a nice downtown area and some small civic centers, but the city lacked a major attraction to bring the community together. It needed summer entertainment and after-school activities for youth. As one Huntsville resident told me, we needed a venue for the community to explode in. And the Stars eventually fit the bill and filled that void. Don Mincher, the general manager, the late John Mincher, said that he was content with an attendance of 250,000 that year, but over 300,000 went through the turnstiles there at Joe Davis Stadium that year. So not only did they lead the Southern League in attendance, they won the Southern League championship in their first year of existence, and just brought a lot of excitement to that area.
Now, the Stars, the Huntsville Stars, you might be able to explain this much better than I, of moving a franchise from Nashville to Huntsville. But when the team was in Nashville, it was a farm club, I think, for the Yankees. And then how does all that wheeling and dealing go on? Because that was kind of fascinating to me, and really a lot of moving parts to getting the team situated in Huntsville in a new stadium that was just finished, you know, within minutes of the team playing there, but also then how that Oakland affiliation happened.
Yeah, and good point. Joe Davis Stadium was built in a little over 33 weeks. So they had to construct that really quick before the Stars arrived there. But I think the impetus of the 1985 Huntsville Stars is essentially driven by a baseball mogul by the name of Larry Schmitto and his vision for Nashville, Tennessee. The story really began in the heart of Schmitto, and he's still alive and doing some great things there in Nashville. He was very generous with his time for this story. Schmitto was this Nashville-born baseball prodigy and savant who championed baseball in Nashville since he was a kid. Growing up there, he was a baseball prodigy and began coaching in his teens. He resurrected Vanderbilt University's putrid baseball program there in the late 1960s and early 70s. And he brought minor league baseball to Nashville in the late 1970s. And he formed that ownership group with country music legend Conway Twitty, who brought in Richard Sturban of the Oak Ridge Boys. So Larry Schmitto was backed by country music money. And he became one of minor league baseball's top executives. The farm club was called the Nashville Sounds, and he was the Barnum and Bailey of minor league baseball. And he had this golden touch. The Sounds were an enormous success. They drew almost 600,000 fans in 1980. The Texas Rangers of Major League Baseball even tapped him to be their director of marketing in the early 1980s. And he was growing an empire of minor league clubs. But interest in the Sounds in the early 80s, in 1983, 84, it was waning. And you have to remember, his ultimate vision was to bring a major league franchise to Nashville. And to this day, the story is still alive because there's still a buzz about a major league franchise expansion team going to Nashville. So there's still a buzz surrounding that. And in July of 1984, he got closer to that dream when he purchased the Evansville Triplets. They were a AAA club. And he felt he needed to bring another big splash to Nashville. And that purchase was critical to Schmitto's vision because it allowed him to elevate Nashville from AA to AAA, which of course is a level right below Major League Baseball. So Schmitto moved that AAA club from Evansville, Indiana, to Nashville. So since Nashville was now hosting AAA baseball in the American Association League, he needed a home for his existing Southern League AA franchise that he owned in Nashville since 1977. I know it could be confusing that there's just a lot of cross-franchise movement. So that's what put in motion Schmitto delivering his AA franchise to Huntsville, Alabama, which hadn't had a pro club in 55 years when the Class D Huntsville Springers folded. So that was kind of how it happened, where in August, Schmitto proposes to bring the AA club in front of the Huntsville City Council in 1984.
And how did the Oakland A's get associated or affiliated with the AA team, the Stars?
During all this movement, Suzanne, with Schmitto moving to Huntsville, the A's simultaneously were basically booted out of Albany, New York, the A's AA farm club. Their contract had ended after the 1984 season. The owner of the Albany Colony franchise there, Ben Bernard, he signed a deal with the New York Yankees. The Yankees wanted their farm club closer to the East Coast. So the Yankees moved from Nashville, their AA farm club in Nashville, to Albany. That left the A's homeless for a AA location. And that's where Walt Jocketty, the A's executive, visited Huntsville, met with Mincher, and saw what the new stadium that was being built, and sensed the excitement around Huntsville, and inked a deal to bring the A's farmhands to populate Huntsville beginning in 1985.
The minor leagues, and I think I would like us to maybe just divert for a second to explain a little bit about their structure. Can you just talk a little bit about the minor leagues and their importance, and kind of how people move through them to get to the majors?
Yeah, well, the minor leagues is a structure where once players are drafted out of high school and college, they go to rookie ball in some cases, and that's kind of the low level. Then there's single A, then there's double A and triple A, and triple A is the level below Major League Baseball. So one thing that stuck out to me in the story is the just intense pressure these minor leaguers feel while playing in these challenging conditions, especially in double A. The Huntsville Stars were playing in the double A classification in the Southern League. And the double A level, that can make or break a prospect. The double A level humbles the most talented, and there are limited roster spots in double A. And double A was very competitive, and it's always filled with top prospects, and is more sophisticated than single A. Most players were on an upward trajectory. That level filters talent for organizations. And AA always separated players. In fact, Walt Jocketty told me that if an executive for the A's, he told me that if a player did well in AA, they could probably play in the major league. So reaching that level was a confidence booster for them. And there was just a lot of pressure for these young players playing in the minor leagues. And double A was just the level right below low triple A, and that's the doorsteps to the big leagues.
Though Huntsville was thrilled to have this double A team, but not all players were necessarily happy to be there. And it seems like there are some pretty good players, like Rocky Coyle is one, who are steady, perform well, are well-liked, but they never make it to the big leagues. While others like Jose Canseco, he was in the majors by the end of that season.
There's the politics of minor league baseball. Not everyone is considered a prospect, and not everyone is going to make it to the major leagues. You have role players. You have players that kind of fill the rosters. So cities and managers and players deal with demotions and promotions in all season. And a lot of the fans there in Huntsville had a hard time adjusting to those politics because they wanted to kind of keep the party going, if you will. So you have phenoms like Jose Canseco, who went through Huntsville and just put up some legendary offensive numbers in only 58 games there. And by July, he was promoted to AAA. By September, he was with the Oakland A's big league club. Eric Plunk, he was the Huntsville Stars top pitcher. And by July, he was promoted to Triple A. So you have those politics there. And players like Rocky Coyle, who stuck around the whole season, he proved to be the heart and soul of that club. Rocky Coyle was this 5'8". He was a fan favorite. And he was so popular in Huntsville, as you read in the book, when the A's demoted him in June to single A Madison, thousands of fans protested and signed a petition to keep him in Huntsville. He hustled and he was just a great leader. Didn't work because he still was demoted. But you have those different characters in the minor leagues, and you have some that are hot prospects and some that are there that are just gonna leave the game with memories of being in minor league baseball. And I interviewed a lot of those players for the book that were excited to reflect on their time in Huntsville.
I'm sure that most players begin their careers with a high expectation and anticipation. But sometimes it seems like in the minor leagues in double-A ball that their expectation is somewhat changed, or their role, or because maybe their regular position changed. I found that kind of fascinating that, like, for instance, Terry Steinbach, who I knew as a catcher, and he eventually becomes a catcher, but he didn't start out that way. And some pitchers, you know, they want to be pitching every day, and then they end up a reliever, so, or a batter who becomes a designated hitter. But that's maybe what the minor leagues are all about.
Yeah, Suzanne, Terry Steinbach was just a great hitter in the minor leagues. And that season in Huntsville, he was a great third baseman coming up before Huntsville. But that season, they converted him from a third baseman to a catcher. And sometimes you have the politics where maybe they already have a prospect that they're grooming for a certain position. So an organization may want to keep this player's bat in the organization, and they see a certain upside in this player, so they're going to move him to another position. The A's had a lot of catchers in the organization, but still they wanted to keep Steinbach's bat, and he ended up being a really great, dependable catcher during his career. So you have all those adjustments, and you have a gentleman by the name of Wayne Giddings. He played for the Stars. He was slated to be in the starting rotation, but that starting rotation was so talented that he couldn't crack it. So he was used as a reliever in the bullpen, and he turned out to be the Stars' best reliever, and he was the closer. I believe he saved 12 games that season for the Stars. So the minor leagues, it is an opportunity and an avenue for the parent club to experiment, to polish, and to maybe adjust players to different positions. The ultimate goal of the parent club trumps everything. So the minor leagues, although they want to develop, they want to win, the ultimate goal is to enhance the parent club, the major league club. And that's where they're able to tinker with these different players, to groom them, and to maybe move them to learn another position. And even you have cases where some hitters became pitchers, some pitchers became hitters. So that's kind of how the context is there.
You mention in the book a couple of times the notion of psychology and sports psychology, and that was something that the organization was behind, of helping these young players figure things out.
Yeah, the Oakland A's were the first organization to bring a full-time psychologist, Harvey Dorfman, to the game. And so Harvey Dorfman arrived in the A's organization and started working with the minor leaguers beginning in 84, 85. And he initially came on board just to help, to offer his services to any of the players dealing with personal problems off the field. Just personal situations they may be involved in with their families, with their significant others, with finances. So he was just a non-threatening figure to assist them if they needed any support in any areas. But he eventually morphed into a counselor where he actually helped them with the mental approach in the game, where he guides them and he gets them to think about certain situations in a game and enhances their ability to navigate through the competitiveness of minor league baseball. And a lot of the players say that having Harvey Dorfman join the organization was the best thing the A's could have done. He helped some of their top prospects develop and adjust to the minor leagues there. So the A's were trailblazers, in a sense, where they brought psychology to the game, and they brought a mental approach to the game that they weaved into their farm system.
Now, the Huntsville Stars, in their inaugural season there, they were really packing in the crowds, and the team members were like celebrities in town. And I think that this was kind of a heady experience for a lot of these young players. During this year of 1985, as you describe it in the book, it was an exciting time for those players, a formative time, but also for the fans in the town of Huntsville, and that their season had its highs and lows, and you really detail that. I don't know, I just found it a fun read, and your pacing of how you tell the story really comes to a wonderful climax. One Season in Rocket City, How the 1985 Huntsville Stars Brought Minor League Baseball Fever to Alabama. Dale Tafoya, is there anything you want to leave us with about Huntsville, the A's, or baseball?
Suzanne, what made the season in Huntsville so celebrated was that this was a minor league club, but it was a major league club to the community as far as they were concerned, and no matter what classification it was. And the residents of Huntsville treated these minor leaguers like celebrities. The community made these minor leaguers the Beatles of Huntsville. Families invited players over for dinner. If a player wanted to go fishing, a fan would take him to a fishing hole. If a player needed to cash their check, a fan would take him to the bank. So the Stars own that town. And again, it's just a testament what a sports franchise can do to a community and how it can impact and transform the community, even economically, and just boost the morale. So, and that's what these minor leaguers really have these fond memories in Huntsville about, because this Huntsville, the community, just embrace these minor leaguers, even though a lot of them didn't make it to the major leagues. They still have fond memories of them. For example, still Rocky Coyle, this great young leader back then on the 1985 team. They have the Rocky Coyle Award still for his leadership in Huntsville. So just I had a great time learning about the book, and the city of Huntsville, the dignitaries, the writers, the community was very helpful in putting this book together. And I was pretty excited how it came out.
And lastly, what are you working on next?
Well, right now, Suzanne, I wrote Billy Ball in 2019. And right after that came out, after all the promotion with that, I went right into writing the book proposal for One Season of Rocket City. So I've been going nonstop since 2019. So now I'm going to, after I do some promotion and interviews for this book, maybe take a break. That's the plan. And I have some other projects up my sleeve. Maybe the 1984 baseball Olympic team. That was the first year baseball was a demonstration sport in the Olympics. I'm wrestling with doing that. So I say I'm going to take a break, but who knows? If you're an author, you may be pulled to do a story and inspired where you can't function or you can't go to bed because it's just burning inside you. And that's kind of when I deal with a story, when I approach a story, if a subject keeps me up at night or it just occupies my mind all the time, I said, okay, it's time to write a book proposal and start pitching it to publishers. That's kind of the state I'm in right now.
Well, congratulations on this book, and thank you so much for talking with us today about it.
Oh, my pleasure. Be well. I had a blast, Suzanne.
One Season in Rocket City, I have been talking with Dale Tafoya, its author. Earlier, we visited with Andy Dolish on his book, written along with Dave Newhouse, Goodbye, Oakland. I am Suzanne Lang. I thank Dale and Andy for talking with me. We have production assistance from Will Penny, Mark Prell, and Max Allen. Our music is from Peter Jacobson. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Stream us online, listen to past shows, and subscribe to our podcast at norcalpublicmedia.org. I thank you for listening. It's a novel idea.